Om Parthaya Pratibhotitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kratitam Puranam Vina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitamritavarshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashajayinim Ambatvamanusantatami Bhagavad Gita Pavadvashini.
Okay, we're in chapter 9, verse 2. Rajavidya Rajaguhyam Rajavidya Rajaguhyam Pavitram Itamuttamam Pavitram Itamuttamam Pratyaksha Bhagamam Dharanyam Pratyaksha Bhagamam Dharanyam Susukham Kartum Avyayam Susukham Kartum Avyayam Rajavidya Raja Guhyam Pavitram Idam Uttamam Pratyaksha Avagamam Dharmyam Susukham Kartum Avjayam. These first two verses, actually it's the first three verses, but the first two verses of chapter 9 are Krishna is enticing Arjuna, is presenting this in such a way to excite Arjuna about this knowledge that he's about to give and about what it means to have Shraddha, what this knowledge actually is for, he's just talking about what this knowledge is. And then in the third verse, he's talking about what a loss it is for those who don't have Shraddha and are not in a position to gain this knowledge. So the first two verses really praise the knowledge, and the third verse praises it negatively. Okay? So here in this verse, it's a continuation of the first verse, really. And he says, talking about this Atmajnanam, it is Rajavidya. Rajavidya means it is the king. Raja means king. It's the king of all knowledges. It's the knowledge which is the king. So in the sense of, it's not a king. Swamiji will say it's not a kingly knowledge. It's the king of all knowledges. Means it's the knowledge which in a sense, in one sense, is the only knowledge, is the only thing that actually is knowledge. So let me just give it little, we're just going to take this word by word because each one of these has to be unfolded. Within empirical reality, this reality that we experience through our sense perception, so this world of duality, all of the knowledge that we gain here through our pramanas, through our means of knowledge, are considered to have validity, to be valid. Like, for instance, perception, as long as your sense perception is valid, as long as you have the proper conditions, that your eyes are in good shape or your hearing is in good shape, and that the world is providing an adequate situation for you to see or for you to hear. For instance, I can't see if it's dark, that type of thing. It will give relatively valid knowledge. Not absolutely valid knowledge. Within duality, it will give a relatively valid knowledge, just like so will inference and presumption and all of the means of knowledge we have available to us, all of which are based upon sense perception. But all of this knowledge that we gain within relative reality takes place within avidya. All of it takes place within ignorance. Because, in fact, the seer-seen duality the knower, knowing, knowledge duality, except itself is mitya. And so Shankara will say all of these means of knowledge that we utilize in order to gain knowledge of the world, right, they're relatively valid, but in the end they're all negated by Atmajnana. Why? Because the very dvaita, the kind of the trilogy between the seer, seen, and seen, knower, knowing, and known, itself is invalid, right? Because in the end, that's all going to be mitya and resolved just into the one Atma. So in that way, none of these knowledges can produce a result that in the end won't be negated. That's kind of the absolute king of knowledges. But on the other, there's different levels of this too. Any knowledge that you gain within empirical reality is itself continually subject to negation on further analysis. That's not negation just by the pramana, by atmajnana. It's negation from within this creation, because every object of knowledge itself can be viewed from a different standpoint, from infinitely different standpoints, and also the object of the knowledge itself is infinitely divisible and subject to infinite relationships. And so no knowledge within empirical reality is, in the end, valid, even within itself. So that's one problem. Yet another problem is that Swamiji lists 5 or 6 of these problems. Another problem is that in empirical reality, the using of our pramanas, our means of knowledge, the more we know, I talked about this a little bit last week, the more we know we don't know, right? And so in that way, it's an endless unfoldment of more and more and more ignorance. That's what they say. The pundit, you know, the scholar, is the one who is the most humble, because they continue unfolding what they don't know, right? Every time you know something, that something that you don't know opens up vistas of ajnanam. And so here, there is no, within duality, there is no resolution of knowledge. There's only an opening of more and more ajnana, more and more avidya, more and more ignorance. Whereas in self-knowledge, atmajnanam, there's a total resolution of the search for the search to know. There's a total resolution. And the reason for that is that the nature of the object of knowledge, which is the self, so say object of knowledge, which is the self, itself is non-dual. In other words, there isn't more than one way to know it. You can't know it from the left side or the right side or from the front or the back, right? There aren't different perspectives. You can't have partial knowledge of it. Like any object in the world, any knowledge you have is going to be partial, only a partial knowledge, because of infinite number of standpoints, infinite number of relationships, and itself infinitely divisible. And so, in fact, there is no way to know it, anything in the creation. You can't actually know it. You can have useful knowledge, but you can't actually know what it is. Whereas, in terms of self-knowledge, that isn't true. You can actually fully, completely know what it is, because it is non-dual and there aren't two ways to know it. You either know it or you don't know it. And so, because of that, it actually not only is the king of knowledges, it is what knowledge actually is, you know? It's what we, when we say knowledge means that it's not subject to negation, right? Something that is true to the object and not subject to negation. And within duality, we don't have that type of a situation. Again, this knowledge is something that bears a result. It bears fruit for something that is actually worth knowing. Because the fruit of this knowledge, right, the fruit of this knowledge is ananda, right? The fruit of this knowledge is my own wholeness or my own completeness. No other knowledge will give me that. No other knowledge will fulfill me. I will be accruing and accruing and accruing and accruing and never reaching the fullness or the, okay, now I know. Now I know. That won't happen, right? All I'll get is now I know this, and I've just uncovered a mountain more of ignorance. So there's never a resolution of, okay, now I know what is. Now I know the truth. Now I know what all this is about. that won't happen within relative reality. And so, but in Atma-jnanam, in Brahma-jnanam, that does happen. There is a fulfillment. So now you do know. You do know what the nature of reality is. And you also know, you also understand what the nature of mitya is. You know, like for instance, say if you recognize the satyam mitya, the satyam is that which actually is. That's Brahman. You recognize what actually is. You recognize what is mitya, what is totally dependent on what actually is. Like you recognize the clay as satyam, you recognize the pot as mitya. You recognize the satchit, your own being, conscious being, as satyam. That's, you have an aparokshajnanam, as we'll see, pratyaksha avagamam is aparokshajnanam, a direct, immediate recognition of what actually is. And then you recognize all of these names and forms that you perceive as mitya, as being total, as having for their being the satyam, that which actually is. That's a direct, immediate recognition. And you also recognize that what is mitya, just through the use of extending your protection or extending your inference, you know, okay, you can do, you can, me? Happy Earth Day. You know? The mitya, what you experience within vyavahara, within in duality, you know that you can't know. Mitya, there's no question of being able to know mitya, because first of all, you can't find it. You can't find anything to know. You can't find anything to know because all of your perceptions within duality are of conglomerates, not of things. This is a conglomerate of many things. This is a conglomerate of many things. This is a conglomerate. Everything that you perceive is not a thing, it's a conglomerate. It's impossible, in fact, to find a thing because everything within the creation is infinitely divisible. And so you understand that. You understand that it's infinitely divisible. You understand that it comes into being and goes out of being. And so the thingness of everything, you know, one of my students writes, the thinginess. There, you can't find the thinginess of things. There's no thinginess here. It's impossible to find it. But in that recognition, in the recognition of the satyam, you find the thinginess. The thinginess is existence as being itself. Right? And none of this, none of these names and forms can themselves resolve into being. They enjoy as the satyam being, which is your own self. This becomes something that you recognize. And so it is not ignorance to say that the perceptions that I have, right, of all things that I experience in the world, even in the mind, on any level of duality, all of these things are in essence unknowable. Because you can't find the end. There's no thinginess there. There's no thing there that you can find. And that's logical. You can understand that. But you can also understand, if you understand the satyam, you can understand that. Because the satyam, your being, is what, no matter how far you divide the creation, how many angles, and in whatever way you look at it, whatever way you analyze it, the one thing that remains as the constant is your being. And if that being is known, right, your being means the consciousness, the awareness, the existence in which everything takes place. Just simply, this is. There is nothing here that doesn't have isness. Nothing. Isness is a given. Being, existence is a given. It's not understood as a given. It's not understood as being in its own right. But once that's revealed, once that's understood, then the being is what's recognized as the truth of all of the names and forms that you experience. And the being itself is you. The being is not, it's a self-evident experience. It's not something which you can objectify and look at. It's something that the entire creation enjoys, but which can't be objectified as, look at this existence. and yet being is known to you immediately and directly in the form of amness. My being, right? My being is directly and immediately known. And then if I ask you to take this amness that makes you you, the existent being that you are, and objectify it, you can't. You can't split it. You can't look at it. You can only be it. And then if you understand that, the being that you are is not something that can be objectified, then you look at all of these things in the room that are objectified. Everything in the room is objectified. I can see the painting, I can see the wall, I can see the cedar chest, I can see the rug, I can see the intervening space, I can see all of you. These are all names and forms, all of which I can perceive with my sense perception, all of which I can dissect infinitely. Because what I'm really perceiving is a room of conglomerates. But I'm perceiving these things and I'm giving all of them existence. But the existence I'm giving them is not something objectifiable. It's my own amness. You know? This is an obvious thing if you think of, like, if I ask you to do the meadow imagination, you imagine a meadow. The meadow imagination comes. Everything in the meadow is. You get rid of the meadow, get rid of the imagination, and what is left? That same isness. Nothing happens to it. The isness is amness. Right? That amness is not objectifiable. But the whole universe is a spread enjoying the isness, which is my amness. Right? It doesn't have it itself, because there's nothing here that you can't find anything here to give it to. Everything here is infinitely divisible. It's kind of like peeling an onion, you know, in a sense that you can't find an object in all of these names and forms, but no matter how much you dissect the object, what does it continue to enjoy? Amness. So we use the example, if I have a clay pot, the clay pot is. If I break the clay pot into shards, the clay shards are. They is, okay? The clay shards are. If I break the shards into dust, the clay dust is. If I put the dust under a microscope, the dust molecules are. The isness never changes at all. Then where does the isness come from? You know? It doesn't come from anything. It is. And everything in the creation enjoys it. So the Raja Vidya, the king of knowledges, is knowing that. Is knowing what really is. Knowing the Satyam, knowing the Mithya. Then you actually know. All of the other things are totally subservient to that. They're not knowledge at all, in fact. It's useful. It's knowledge within ignorance, right? Knowledge within avidya, knowledge within mithya, but it's not knowledge of what actually is. And so this vidya, the brahmajnanam, self-knowledge, knowledge of the nature of reality, that's considered the Raja Yoga, the Raja Vidya. And that is called Raja Guhyam. That knowledge is the greatest secret. It is the king of secrets. Guhyam means secrets. So that knowledge, that Raja Vidya, is Raja Guhyam. It is the greatest secret. Swamiji says something. There's a couple of things here. One is, it's the greatest secret because it is yourself. Right? And all of your sense organs and all of your organs of action are only subservient to mithya. They only are good for within duality. Right? So what is the Raja Vidya is the greatest secret because it is hidden in the seeker. In fact, it is the seeker. It is the truth of the seeker. And so the seeker is looking all over for it. Right? Searching to complete myself, to gain knowledge, to know. But using the means of knowledge that are within duality. It's like a dream character in a dream is looking all around, what's the truth of this dream? But you have means of knowledge that will just help you analyze the dream. That's all, only within the dream, only within mithya. So it's not going to resolve. You need someone an Upanishad, right, to come up and hold up a mirror to the nature of the one who is the self of the seeker, the one who itself can't be objectified, but which is the very basis of the reality. So there's that. That makes it a great, great secret. Swamiji brings another point here, and I thought was nice. Those things which are valuable, of great value in samsara, in mitya, those things that are of great value, they are kept secret. In fact, the valuable things you have, he uses the example of, you know, how wealthy people will buy very expensive jewelry and then they'll lock it in their safe and wear, costume jewelry, imitations, because it's of such value, it's worth so much money that they don't dare bring it out because somebody might take it. And so these things of great value are kept very, very secret because of fear of loss, fear of being lost. So people become insecure, and so they hide the things that are of great value and precious. But here, this secret of secrets, this thing which is so difficult in a sense that can't be objectified and known in the world without a means of knowledge, this secret, this great, great secret, is of great value, and it doesn't make you insecure. So this secret, this great and most valued secret, is something that no one can take from you. And so, in fact, with this most secret, this king of the secret knowledges, this which is most of the most valued secret, gives you security. All of the other great secrets don't give you security. In fact, they make you insecure. So Swamiji gives that as one of the reasons for that Rajaguhyam, that which is the king of secrets. Then it says, so here Krishna says, and this is also pavitram uttamam. Uttamam means it is the greatest, the most exalted. Pavitram means purifier. It brings about the greatest, the most, it's the greatest purifier, bringing about antakarana shuddhi. And the reason is that even with dharma, within duality, nobody can do it perfectly. You know, there's no possibility of not making mistakes. And so Swamiji says, you know, like if you're a perfectionist, you're going to be unhappy with yourself. Yeah. If your focus of perfection, you know, exists within duality, you're not going to be perfect. You're going to be doing this wrong, or making that mistake, or hurting this person, or doing this, or doing that. You know, or you can always say, you know, I could have done that better, or I wish I hadn't made that mistake. I wish I hadn't made that mistake. Even somebody told me that I made the mistake. You know, I made this mistake, and people even point out that I made this mistake. How not to feel guilty? How not to feel badly about all of the mistakes that you've made? If you've looked back and said, I hurt this person, I did that, and I did that, I wish I hadn't done that, and I wish I could be better at this. It's absolutely endless. How to get out of this? You have to get, the only way out really is to get beyond the whole punya and papa. You know, you have to go beyond punya and papa. Punya are those actions which everybody that with, from the standpoint of Ishvara, that action is within dharma. It's within dharma. It brings merit. It'll bring a better next life, you know. It's something that you can be happy about. Papa are those things which create pain for you and others. You say punya are those things that create happiness or security or something positive, dharma, you know. But the problem is that you start seeing that every punya is laced with papa, you know. It's very hard to do anything that is perfectly fine from all standpoints. Very, very tricky thing. And so, you can always do it better. It's just the same thing for yourself as a person, you know, say you're an ambitious perfectionist, right? Whatever degree you are, terrible situation. Because we're in duality, you could always have done it better. Could always have done it better, you know. You could always be better, you know. And you can always fall from where you are. That's the nature of duality, you know. And so how to get out of it? How to get out of that? Is to get out of duality. I have to wreck the one that is free of what we call mala, you know, that impurity. The one who is free of impurities is only one. Is the Atma, is the Self. And so the only way to get out of this, as Swamiji just does like two or three pages, if you read the handout, you know, two or three pages on this, couple pages. The only way out of this, you know, is to have your self-identity, can't be the Ahankara. The self-identity has to be the Atma. If the self-identity is the Atma, the Punya and Papa become Mitya. Punya and Papa is given over to Ishvara. And I'm free. I am free of it. But the Atma really is the only one that is free of it. So that way, this knowledge is the greatest purifier, because everything else, every other type of purification is time. But there's a lot of problems with it. Anything we do within Dharma, within duality, to purify our mind, or to purify our body, or to purify our behavior, anything we do is time-bound. Right? Here you've done a karma, you've done a punya karma. Now you've done that, and you get a positive result. But that's over now. See? That's the problem. That punya karma is over. And so we have a next one. Now you have to do another punya karma. You have a good attitude. You have a good attitude for this moment. Difficult situation, you have a good attitude. You've handled it well. Now that situation's over. Your good attitude and the situation are over. Now there's another situation. Now you have to have another good attitude. Do you remember that? Mark Markowitz used to sit in a chair right here for years. He came.
Yeah.
That older man, he was a Ramakrishna kind of a monk. Do you remember him?
Yeah, tall and skinny.
For so many years he was here. I'll never forget what he said. He said, you know, we're like a spiritual maintenance man. Because he was at the ashram and trying to live this life. But it's like, you're a spiritual maintenance man. You know, because you have to maintain perfectly. And here's a little papa creeping in here and there and there. That's how it is. If you are identified with, you know, your mind and body and sense organs, then this is a continual process. Your antakarana shuddhi is a continual process. It's not true when there's jnanam, because the self is not in process. The Atma is not in process. It is what it is, and it's dharma by nature. Not in terms of dharma, adharma. It's the very self of dharma. Right? And so it itself is pure. And so Brahma jnanam becomes the ultimate purifier, because it gives you to you what is actually pure, which is the discovery of your own being. Discovering of your own being, of the Atma, is what is pure. Everything else is subject to the three gunas, actually. Everything else is subject to continual change, you know, and influenced by one thing or another, and is good from one perspective and not good from another. It's very difficult. It's a mixture, you know. It's a mixture of punya and papa. If we just had pure punya, we'd just catapult right up to Brahmaloka. Right? And pure papa, you'd go down to Naraka. We're here dealing with this continual mixture. And so, if it weren't for Brahma Jnanam, Dharma itself, the practice of Dharma, would be the greatest purifier. Because the practice of Dharma has all to do with attitude. You know, it has to do with the choice of dharma in spite of pleasure, the pleasure and pain of the world. My commitment is to dharma, and I have more control over that than I do over sensory enjoyments in the world. And so dharma, within duality, is the greatest purifier. But then dharma is subject to adharma, right? Subject to, you have to maintain the dharma. The atma, you don't have to maintain. And so that which gives that knowledge of the atma is the greatest purifier, because it gives you what is actually pure. So it is uttamam, means it's ultimate. It is what ultimately takes you to that which is free of dharma and adharma, free of punya and papa. So that's called the pavitram idam uttam. Uttam idam means this. This is the most exalted purifier. And this knowledge is pratyaksha avagaman. Avagaman means knowledge. It's a knowing, which is pratyaksha. Here, pratyaksha doesn't mean sense perception. It means that which is direct and immediate, which is itself different from all other knowledges. Right? It's by pratyaksha here, they mean aparoksha. It's direct and immediate. In all of the other knowledges, there is a seer-seen differentiation, a knower-known differentiation. And so I have to gain knowledge of something which is objectified by me, right? And so using my sense organs and my various means of knowledge, I gain knowledge of this thing. So that whatever knowledge I gain is going to be within, first of all, it's going to be within subject-object duality. It's going to be within duality. The object is going to be away from me. And so I have to gain it, and then I have to remember it also, right? But here, this knowledge is different. This knowledge is not of something which is away from me. It's not something that I can objectify. It's a totally different kind of knowledge. It's a knowledge of the one, of the self, you know, that objective, that the self that illumines the mind. Right? In all other kinds of knowledge, the mind gains the knowledge of something external to itself. Say, for instance, through pratyaksha. Right? It gains a knowledge of something that I illumine. Self-knowledge is of the self which is illumining the mind. So here, in either case, whether I'm gaining knowledge of the painting or of anything else, my mind uses those sense organs, my sense organs, like my eyes. I gain a thought modification, say, of the painting. Then I illumine the painting. Consciousness illumines that vritti, that thought modification of the painting. Right? And then if I go away, say if I go outside and I'm not looking at the painting anymore,
it's gone.
The painting's gone. I have to recall the painting into my mind and have a memory of it. Right? And so all knowledge is like that if it's based on something that comes and goes. Right? That I need my pramanas, I need my means of knowledge in order to know that thing. Then I gain a thought modification of it, and then it is known. I walk away, and then the only way I can know it again is to bring it back through memory. Right? So if I have a memory loss of that, I can't get it back. I won't even know that I ever knew it. Right? This is different, because this knowledge, it does require a vritti, does require a thought modification, but the thought modification removes the ignorance of myself. And so the very conscious being, which you already have direct immediate knowledge of, in terms of I am, I exist, I am a conscious being, I have a direct immediate knowledge of that. I don't know what it is, I just know that I am conscious. I have the experience of consciousness, immediate. Nobody's lighting that up for me, it's the bottom line. I know that I am a conscious being. I exist and I am conscious. Nobody has to prove that to me. Right? But I don't know that the consciousness I am is limitless, is changeless, is the self of the world. I don't know that. And so I need a vritti, a thought modification through jnanam, that will illumine that for me, make me see that, hold up a mirror to that. But once that ignorance is removed, that self is known, period. I can't have a memory of it. You can't have a memory of something which is always there. The ignorance has been removed. So now it's done. Once you know, now it's not about memory at all, you know, because it's knowledge of the one who is always present. Right? And so that knowledge is of a different order, right? It's a direct, immediate knowledge of something which is direct and immediate. See, the self, yourself, is direct and immediate by its very nature. Nothing has to light it up. It is consciousness. Consciousness which is limitless. Okay? But I didn't know that. Now I have a means of knowledge that makes me recognize that fact, differentiate the fact of myself from all of these things that require objectification. Once I'm known, I'm known. And where am I going? Where is the mind going to go to forget it? Or where am I going to go to be away from the mind? And so the self itself is self-evident. The ajnanam has been removed. And so the problem is over. There's nothing more to be done. And so this knowledge is direct and immediate as opposed to everything else. Everything else requires, you know, what a vritti, right? Here, for the knowledge of vritti is required, but once the knowledge is there and the self is known, a vritti is no longer required. You know? You don't have to say, oh, what was that? You know? Let me remember that. It's not about memory. Once known, it is you. It's always there. So there's no question of remembering.
Well, you can't remember it.
You can't really remember it because there's no time to forget it. You know, there's no removal of yourself to forget it. Swamiji says something interesting here. I'd never heard him say it exactly like this. He goes like this. Some people will ask this question. If, say you get into some sort of an accident and you become brain dead. And become brain dead or something. But you know, you're a jnani. Will do you still know? He said, yes, you still. And so if you still know, then at the time of death, say for instance, you become brain dead now, you're not going to have your brain back. You're brain dead. As long as you have this physical body. Do you still know? Or are you still a jnani? Yeah. He says, absolutely. It's just like when you go to sleep at night, at that time you don't have access to your knowledge, you know, from the standpoint of the antikarana. But when you wake up, you know, right? Yourself hasn't gone anywhere. And so, in other words, what he's saying is not dependent at all. It's dependent upon the removal of ignorance, not upon the use of a memory. And since that ignorance has been removed, when the body drops, just since now there's not going to be any more ajnanam or a state like deep sleep, then that person, as you are, you know. Just like now, you can say, if you look like this, if you know yourself, then, this is a little tangential but still important, and it's a nice segue. If you know, then no matter what type of a thought you're having, you may not like the thought. You know, it may be an emotion. You may not like the emotion. It may be a reaction. You don't like the reaction. Whatever is going on, you like it or you don't like it. It's painful or it's not. It is what it is. It can be happy or it can be painful. But whatever is going on with the mind, you may like it or not like it. But whatever it is, it has nothing, it in no way covers yourself. That's for ajnani. It in no way covers yourself. But you can say, I have to work on myself, meaning my mind. I have to work on my mind, or I have to work on my attitude, or I have to do some work on my complexes, or whatever. I have to work on these things. Because why? Because they're causing pain. They're generating pain. I have to work on those things, work on my attitude. But that is making no comment whatsoever about me, the self that I am. The self that I know, you know. You can say, you know, there's an emotional lag time from once you have knowledge and from your mind catching up and working through all its complexes, you know, taking care of the attitudes that are producing pain and all of this type of thing. That stuff goes on. That's, you know, that you, there's work to be done there. If somebody comes to this knowledge, say somebody comes to this knowledge, there has to be a mumukshu or somebody who desires liberation. They come to this knowledge with a lot of baggage, or medium amount of baggage, you know, or minimal amount of baggage. But their prarabdha, the karma, brought you to your teacher at this particular time, coming with more or less baggage. Say somebody comes to the teacher, to their teacher, with hardly any baggage. That means hardly any complexes. They've had just a, you know, cherished type of life. Good parents, good friends. They're also attractive enough not to be teased in school and all of these kind of things that can happen to give children complexes that you have to grow up with, you know.
Yeah.
All of these kind of things. So they didn't have much of that, you know. So they come to the teacher with not very much baggage. But then, you know, how long did they have to work to come to get rid of all of that baggage, you know, over the various lifetimes? They had to work and work and work and work, and finally they have all this punya and they come finally to the teacher and they're all nice and shiny and clean and they come to the teacher. You can say, if you come with a lot of baggage, I'm sorry, I just got here earlier. I got here earlier, meaning that I didn't have time to work through all of that baggage before I came, because the mumukshutvam came to me, you know, before I had gotten rid of a lot of this baggage. Whereas for you, the mumukshutvam came, you know, when after you had gotten rid of a lot of the baggage. And so it's all about mumukshutvam, you know. I became a mumukshu with this much baggage. The other person, yes, and I became a mumukshu with this much baggage. Whatever the amount of baggage is, that stuff has to be sorted out. Why does it even have to be sorted out? Because of pain. You know, it's kind of like, I came to this knowledge with a broken arm. And you came to this knowledge, you know, with a broken finger. The broken finger needs to be fixed. Because even though you know who you are, the finger's broken, and it hurts. And even though you know who you are, the arm is broken, and that hurts more. Yeah. And so it's the same. This mind, because of the conditioning, it has this and that and this and that and this and that attitudes and complexes and things that hurt. And so the whole samsara, the whole creation, wants to heal itself. You know, if it can be healed, if something which is creating pain can be healed, then it will naturally, you'll naturally try to heal it. Just imagine, because the thing like this, you have knowledge, you know yourself, that is done. You know the mityatva. You understand. Nobody's going to make you know it anymore in terms of your own being. Nobody can make you know it more. But, you know, there's this quirk in the mind causing pain. There's this thing in the mind that's causing pain, a way of being, you know, that is hurtful. Does it make sense to have this knowledge, to enjoy yourself, and then just let the quirk be? Why? Why let the thing that's causing pain be? I'm saying it's not natural. It's not natural just to let it be. The only reason you'll let it be is because it's not bothering you. If it's bothering you, then you'll work to fix it. Does that mean that you don't have knowledge? No. But you can say like this, my house is not clean. My house is dirty. Oh, it doesn't matter. Well, what it matters is that I like to be in a clean house. It's more comfortable. It's much more comfortable. And so I'll make sure to some way figure out to keep it clean. You know? Same with the mind. If the mind is behaving in a way that is continually causing pain, you know, it's not natural to want to be satisfied with that. And so you'll work on it until the mind enjoys a natural shanti. Enjoy it, makes that pain, because it's baggage that has to be worked through. Swamiji had gotten very sophisticated about all of this. I've told this story before about one time in Powai, Sandeepani Sanalaya in India. He was sitting in his little kutir, and he was doing this trick with a matchbox, with a you know, those matches that have a flap. And so he was doing this trick showing how you can light it by pulling the match down with your thumb, you know, and then going like that, right? And so he was showing this, and then the whole thing blew up in his hand. Well, you know, thing blew up in his hand. And he went, something like that, you know? And then he didn't like that. He didn't like that he was startled like that, you know? And so he thought about that, you know? Why should he be startled like that? That's where you get, you know, a little sophisticated with the whole thing. So your mind, but really, when you look at it, your mind, you know, reacts in a certain way. If Swamiji would take that seriously, say, why did I react like that? And he says here in this chapter, he says, you know, the only thing that stops a person from becoming, every person, he says, every person can become mature. To gain knowledge, what you need is maturity. To gain this knowledge, you need some maturity, you need some shanti, for the mind to be available, to be able to really own it and relax in it. You need some maturity. Everybody can gain that maturity. He says, it's just, all it takes is, how much attention do you pay to the way your mind behaves? How much, you know, effort do you make? How much attention do you pay? You know, like say your mind reacts to something, or your mind behaves in a way that creates a sorrow inside. Do you say, oh, what's that? You know, do you do some, you know, some, you do some vichara on that. You sit with that, you know, and analyze it and work with it. And then say, you know, next time, it's kind of an auto-suggestion, next time I'm going to do that differently. That's how a person becomes mature. Otherwise, you just automatically, what the heck, you know, and the next time it happens again, and when's this going to stop happening? But for somebody who's really interested in that, you pay attention. And that's how the mind, you know, changes, because you pay attention to it. And so, because this knowledge is direct, it's what we call susukam. It's actually very easy. This knowledge is very easy to gain because it's not away from you. There's nothing you have to do. You just need some maturity in the mukshatvam. If there's anything difficult, it's gaining the maturity, you know, in the mumukshutvam. But in terms of gaining the knowledge, you know, it is you. There's no place to go. There's nothing that you have to do. You just need a teacher. If the teacher is there, you know, and you're a mumukshu, there's nothing. That's all you need. You don't need anything else. You don't need money. You don't need anything. You just need to be there. You don't need to exert yourself. No exertion required. That's the system. And it's, this knowledge is dharmyam. Even though it's beyond punya and papa, it's actually beyond dharma, this knowledge is actually ordained in the Shruti, in the Upanishads, where it says, this knowledge, it uses this tavya affix, this knowledge is to be understood. It is to be heard, the shravana. It is to be thought over. You know, it is to be contemplated on. This is an injunction, actually. In the Upanishads, the first part of the Vedas, the injunctions are for dharma. In the Upanishad, the injunction is for, you must gain, this knowledge is to be gained. That's how it's enjoined in the Upanishads. And so it's actually part of the whole dharma, right? it's part of the Vedic Dharma. So this is something which is to be known. Who is it to be known by? The mumukshu. Until a person is a mumukshu, then they're contained by Dharma. But when contained by Dharma, you know, then a person over time will naturally become a mumukshu. The mumukshutvam comes due to assimilation of one's experience. So one assimilates experience and they're living a dharmic life, they will come to that question. You know, like, is there anything beyond the opposites? Is there anything about me that is free? Is there anything about me that is free? Is there such a thing as moksha? What is that? That person does, the dharmic life will, in the end, take you to that mumukshutvam, take you to moksha. So that's the whole Vedic Shastra. So they say, dharmyam, this knowledge is not beyond, is not outside of Dharma. It is the very, it is something that is enjoined by the Vedas itself. And then it says, it is something which is avyayam. Avyayam means it's not subject to any type of decay. So, okay, let's stop here. I'll do a couple of more things on this verse, and then we'll do verse 3-2 next week. Okay. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamadachate Purnasya Purnamadahya Purnameva Vasishate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Gurupyo Namaha Harihi Om.
It seems like there's a dual process going on here, where you have to pay attention to your being, which is natural, and also you pay attention to mind. You know, the noticing part.
Well, there, yeah, in the sense that I think, once you know yourself, there's no distance. There's nothing not to know about yourself. There is a lot to understand about the nature of creation. I mean, just Atma. Once you know yourself and you recognize it, you know that's what who you are. That's clear. The relationship of the jiva, this body, mind, sense organs, to Ishwara, and recognizing yourself as the whole, you know, takes some time and assimilation. So that's where you have to keep listening and listening and listening, really, to resolve the jiva into Ishwara. You know, all the upadis have to resolve into Ishwara. But once you know yourself, that's in terms of the Atma. There's no time or space there. There's no distance. It is you. But now you've got your mind. Your mind is just an instrument, and your sensory, they're just an instrument. They're no problem at all. You don't have to be watching them or anything. You don't have to worry about them, except when they are producing pain. Right? Because a lot of time your mind isn't producing pain at all. It's just functioning. Like your sense organs are functioning, they're working, and your mind is helping you, does all kinds of things for you. But it's just working as an instrument. But then because of attitudes that are really just a product of ignorance. You know, there's certain habits and values and things that prior to knowledge caused us pain, and now we become aware of them in the light of knowledge, and yet they're habitual. Right? And so because they're habitual, you have to take them, you have to apply yourself, you know, to when the mind is producing pain, it's at that time when you have to be present to it and say, what is that really? What's going on there? You know, and then we learn all kinds of tools really for how to do that, even to deal with it psychologically, to know how to be with it, to know how to hold it, to know how to apply, to bring our values in light of our knowledge to apply to it. You know, there's certain skills involved there in being able to kind of help the mind change. But if you're not, you know, using not just your knowledge, but also your psychological knowledge to help the mind reorient itself, you know, in light of who you are now, right? But that takes some commitment.
Yeah, because it seems like it doesn't, if there's a problem like that, it doesn't get just better by itself. I mean,
it doesn't get better by itself if it's not tended to. Like, say that there is going to be some tending to, because once you have knowledge, you're a different person in a sense than you were before you had knowledge. So now, whatever the problem is going to comes up to your buddhi, you know, to you, the one who has knowledge. And now this new you, the you of this moment, you know, is now present to this problem, you know. But there has to be this one has to have some interest in transforming that way of thinking or that way of feeling, you know, of working on it, you know, rather than being overwhelmed by it. See what I mean? Like the buddhi can be overwhelmed by it and then just go with it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so as long as that's the case, the buddhi, the mind overwhelms and just goes, takes the buddhi for the ride, you know, then there's nothing really happening there, except when the ride is over, you know, then you can say something like, which you may not say, but you can say, the next time this happens, I want to try to catch it. I want to be like this toward that. Then that's like an auto-suggestion, you know. But that's also requires some consciousness. Somebody inside has to do that, has to say.
You have to decide.
You have to decide that you would like to work on that problem.
You know?
Even things like Pratipaksha Bhavana, yeah. You know. Pratipaksha Bhavana is when, say there's somebody who you hate, you can't stand, whatever it is. Pratipaksha Bhavana is just either in real time, in physical world, doing something such as offering that person a flower every day, some equivalent of that. You know, even though it's at the beginning it feel horrible and be phony, you still make yourself do it. Or you do it mentally, some sort of thing that opposes, that is the opposite of that feeling that you don't like, because it changes the structure of the mind. That can be difficult to do until you get practiced at it. And then it's so powerful, it becomes easy for you to do. You have a value for doing it. But these are skills. What were you going to say, Danielle?
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, it's sort of like to juxtapose two things. One thing is, I heard someone asks in a satsang with Swamiji, ask him, like, when you gain knowledge, Swamiji, did it change after that or something? And he says something really nice. He used this example of a Polaroid picture.
Uh-huh.
And he said it's like watching a Polaroid picture develop. And so what you said about Ishwara, that sounds like that. And yet also it seems to me that there's another kind of way that knowledge occurs or something, in that sometimes it seems like okay, you get that recognition of your Atma, you know, as distinct.
Mm-hmm.
And but then it seems like it can be almost like a two-part process where that's pretty clear, or that is clear, but then, you know, that all of this has for its being your being, that seems like it can be like a two-step kind of process. And I once asked Swamiji about that, and he said that what prevents that is this inner child kind of work. So would you say that it can be this sort of two-step process?
Well, yeah. See, once you say you're the Atma, just that self is recognized, then that's recognized.
Yeah.
Okay, but the recognition that I am the whole, that can be like the Polaroid.
Right.
Swamiji's example of the Polaroid, that I am the whole. And then also, so there's that. Then there's the mind's settling, so that the mind itself naturally enjoys shanti. That's also a kind of Polaroid thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But why? Now, the thing that's important with that's true, that the mind, as it matures in the light of knowledge, it becomes different. It relaxes. And so it's a nicer mind to be with because it's relaxed. But the relaxation of the mind and the shanti of the mind belongs to the mind. It doesn't belong to the self, other than it's mitya, and that way there's nothing but the self. But from the standpoint of the mind, the shanti of the mind is very pleasing, and it's I call it a secondary gain of this knowledge. The knowledge itself is I am the whole, and that I am the whole cannot take place until the Atma is recognized, because how do you know what the whole is? Okay. But if the mind is, once the self is known, if the mind is dull or upset or shanti, it doesn't cover the self. And that's the thing that needs to be known. Because otherwise, you're waiting to know the self for the mind to become a certain way. But you have to recognize the self that is present no matter what the mind is.
But more, I was thinking more in terms of like what you talk about, this pratibandhaka jnana, which I think may obstruct the you are the whole.
But pratibandhaka jnana, yeah. Emotions, raga, dvesha can all be obstructions for that, you know. Raga, dvesha means likes and dislikes that give this. The mind falls into I need this. It just drags you into duality, and so that's a maturing that takes place over time, because until you gain knowledge, that's all we know really. Because, you know, I need either I need this to be happy, or I need my mind to be like this to be happy, or I need to have, you know, this and that and this and that to be happy. You know, and so those strong likes and dislikes, the complexes in the mind that pull me into emotional states that are very believable, and so as though become, you know, a samsari.
You know, I've also heard Swamiji say that a knowledge vritti is not necessarily
a what?
A knowledge vritti is not necessarily a one-time vritti. You can bring that vritti back. You know, you do that when you're doing nitya dhyasana, you know, it's a kind of, it's like you don't really forget yourself, but you can as though forget yourself in the...
Well, because the mind can be so overwhelming.
Right. So you can, like, would you call that kind of like just focusing on, you know, you bring that vritti back?
I look at it as nitya dhyasana, where your mind gets, you slow down everything, and your mind develops a relationship with yourself.
Mm.
So that it's used to being with you instead of running around, you know, being with other things.
Mm-hmm.
It gets used to your own nature. It gets used to that, the ananda, which is you. Not the ananda, like bliss or something, as a mental state that takes place in the world, but the ananda, the wholeness or fullness, which is your being. then it becomes more and more at wanting to stay home. Mm-hmm. Staying home, it enjoys the, it experiences the world. And it wants to stay home because the home base yourself is Ananda. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the real home, it's the real fullness, it's the real joy that doesn't even, joy, not joy in a relative out here, vritti sense, but the real wholeness. You know, that is so fulfilling and satisfying. It would rather be there. And then, so that mind gets used to staying home, and then it has a natural, develops more and more of a natural shanti, so it's not out creating pain, you know. Mm-hmm. But to me, what's so critical is in this whole thing is that, is to be able to help the mind to recognize that yourself is not covered in any way, even when it's a terrible dukkha-vritti, very sorrowful thought. It's not covered at all. But when that's recognized, then that thought, that sorrow, has a home to resolve into. You know, it's being, the sorrow is held by the benign nature of yourself. You know, and so you are never in sorrow, in fact. But you can hold sorrow. The self holds sorrow. It itself is not in sorrow. The sorrow still hurts, but it's not alone. It's held by the fullness of yourself. You know? Like hurt hurts, whatever kind it is. It's not that it doesn't hurt, but it's not alone now.
So are you running back? Are you running back to the mind?
To the self?
The self?
Well, there's really no distance between the mind and the self.
Well, but something's happening there.
It's a recognition. Instead of being turned out toward the problem, it relaxes into the self, which in fact is whole. Mm. So the problem is never away from the wholeness of your being. Mm. But see, if you're looking for a mental state.
Yeah, I'm looking for both. I mean, I like my own being, which is home.
Yeah.
And I want my mental state to evaporate.
That's fine, but then you have to know both. If your own being is there, present to you completely, without being covered, the painful mental state, and it's there in the happy mental state too. And then the painful mental state, we want to work on and change so that it can have that it can just enjoy its natural shanti. Because what's causing the pain is ajnana. You know, habitual ajnana, habitual ignorance.
Well, wait, that doesn't quite make sense to me.
Habitual ignorance.
No,
habitual.
I know. I heard the words, but you say what's causing the pain is ajnana, but if you have ajnana, how is ajnana?
It's a bit habitual because that's the emotional lag time. The mind is so used to, or that's the pratipaksha bhavana, in the sense the mind is so used to, I mean, that's the pratibandhika jnana. The mind is so used to behaving in this way, it's so used to projecting, you know, my ananda onto the world.
So
you have to pull it back.
So it's like this sort of residual kind of jnanam or habitual. But it's
habitual.
You don't really have jnanam, but it's kind of like some kind of, I don't know, like leftover or something.
Yeah, it is kind of like that. It's, you know, it's habitual. That's why we talk about emotional lag time. Because we've got, you know, how many interconnected vrittis, you know, that are all have for their core ajnana, lifetimes, you know. And so they all have to kind of, the ones that are kind of important to us or make our structure, they all have to raise up their heads, you know, in light of my knowledge. And then be assimilated.
So that's why Swamiji didn't like that match thing, because it was kind of like
ajnanam. Yeah, kind of.
That's funny.
Yeah. He laughed too, but still, you know, he also worked on it. But that was kind of a good lesson to me.
And that he noticed it.
Yeah.
He noticed.
He didn't let, and still never does, let things slip through. One time years ago, he told me, how did he say it? You can't let your knowledge go even for a moment.
You can't.
Don't let your knowledge go even for a moment. That's not quite how he said it, but the idea was... The idea was something to the effect that, you know, if the samsara can be rough, there's a lot of things that go on in your life that are difficult, you know? And you're either experiencing it from a standpoint of knowledge or you're getting sucked in mm-hmm. to it. Don't let yourself get sucked in. Mm-hmm. Bring yourself back with your knowledge. That's what he was saying.
I saw a Chekhov play last night, and in the program they had some quotes from Chekhov. And I liked one of them. He said, originality is the triumph over habit.
Oh.
That's funny. It's still some
being
well, you could say the same about knowledge, really.
So being startled is... He was concerned about being startled, losing his, the peaceful mind, or he was looking at the mind?
No, he just wasn't conscious of what was going on, and there was no reason for him to be startled. I mean, I don't know.
Okay.
I didn't analyze it that far.
No. That's good. It was deepening.
I have a question. I think it's more than technical, and I'm not confident that I'm up to it because I thought I knew where my question was coming from, but it's about something that he says in the commentary. About the vritti, once the vritti that removes the ignorance goes away, leaving the pala. And I just wondered what he meant by that, and I had some idea what he must mean, but then he mentions it again later. He goes into it a little bit more, and what he says about it doesn't line up with what I was assuming. When I first read it, I was just thinking about how the vritti goes away because it never really lands on the self. I mean, because the self isn't an object of knowledge, it's kind of just a pointer. It leads the mind to the recognition. And so I was thinking that once that the self is recognized, then the vritti goes, that self-knowledge is no longer a vritti. It's sort of unmediated. It's a direct perception, a direct recognition, sort of a reflection in the buddhi. But I thought, so that's kind of the direction my thinking was going originally.
Let me explain it, because I think it's a little different than maybe what you're thinking. The situation is that the self experience is already present, whereas the painting experience isn't. It's not present unless I use my eyes to look at it and gain a vritti. So I make it present by the vritti. Okay? And so then when the vritti goes away, the painting goes away also. Right? And then I bring it back through memory. So they have a term for this. They say, when knowledge takes place for something that needs to be objectified, there's first what they call vritti vyapti, where the vritti pervades the object. That means the object has to come into the vritti. The vritti assumes the form of the object. And having assumed the form of the object, it is then illumined, right? So if the vritti doesn't take the form of the object, then it can't be known. It has to take the form of the object, and then it is known. Not that it's sequential, but it has to take the form of the object in order for consciousness to illumine it, right? So that's how knowledge takes place in the world. But here, the vritti vyapti, because the vritti now recognizes the self through that teaching methodology, the self that illumines the vritti, right, is now objectified by the vritti in the sense that the vritti takes the form, not objectified, that'll confuse you, the vritti takes the form of the self. So, in other words, it's like consciousness illumines the vritti, and now the vritti is, instead of focusing on an object out there, is turned on itself, kind of like a mirror. It's turned on the self, kind of like a mirror. And so the self that was illumining the vritti is now the content of the vritti. So there's no vritti, that's the vritti vyapti. Now there's no pala vyapti. There's no one there to illumine the consciousness, because the consciousness is what is there. Right? And so now the ajnanam has been removed, because the vritti was in ignorance. It was just illumined by consciousness, but it just took itself to be the consciousness. Now it's recognized the consciousness. Right? And the ajnanam has been removed, just leaving the consciousness. There is no even palavyapti. There's no consciousness now that has to come in and illumine the vritti, because all that's there is consciousness, because the vritti itself is turned toward consciousness. So consciousness is its content, rather than its conscious content being like a painting which is illumined by the vritti. So there's no palavyapti, there's just the consciousness itself which is known, and that's the very fruit.
I just don't see how we can say that the vritti remains, because consciousness...
No, it doesn't remain.
Oh, I thought you were saying that it does.
No.
Then
it doesn't remain. The one instant it sees it, you don't need that vritti anymore.
Right.
Yeah. It doesn't remain at all.
I don't even see how a vritti can... That it would even be possible, because consciousness doesn't have any attributes. So what is the vritti going to be of?
It's not going to be of anything that has name and form. Mm. It's just going to be of consciousness itself.
But
so it's the vritti as though erases itself.
Right.
It doesn't go into non-existence. That's why you can have a nirvikalpa samadhi type experience. We say the vritti becomes what's called ati sukshma. It's a very subtle vritti. Mm-hmm. Because the vritti itself, the sattva, which is made, the only thing it is doing now is it's not creating, it does no form of its own in terms of like a thought or imagination or something. It's got no outside form. It's as though the pot just turning in toward the clay, mm-hmm. or the vritti turning toward its own true content, which is consciousness. And then now you have the self-evident consciousness illumining a vritti which has only turned toward the consciousness. So the vritti becomes something that's not even cognizable.
But you keep saying that the vritti, so the vritti does remain.
What do you mean by remain? It only can take place in a split second. What's the remaining?
Well, I feel like the way you're saying then the vritti is there and all it is...
Well, I'm trying to explain that moment that the vritti is there. I'm not talking... I never said remains.
Okay.
The vritti has to take place, though. If a vritti takes place, even if it's for a second...
Then what is that vritti of in that split second?
Consciousness.
What is that? That's the part I'm not understanding, because I'm thinking vritti is like a thought modification, and in order to have a thought modification, there has to be something to create that... form, or that...
Well, what if you look, there's no form.
Right.
What if consciousness, you can accept that...
I think of vritti as form, that's why I'm saying it's...
Vritti isn't... form can be whatever is the content of the vritti.
But that sounds like vritti is some kind of entity. So maybe the question is about what is meant here by...
Well, when you say...
It's like when I have
it is some,
this cup...
Yeah.
I understand... vritti. But then when this cup is taken away and
yes.
there's nothing, say, nothing here in my field of perception.
Then what? Of course there is something in your field of perception.
What?
Whatever's in the rug.
No, I'm saying if.
But there always will be something in the field of perception.
Don't the words akhanda akara pretty... Because that's... We haven't used that yet, this class, but doesn't that pretty much describe that akhanda akara? I mean, if you translated it, isn't that...
Yeah. Well, the akhanda akara vritti is a vritti, you know, whose akara, whose form is akhanda. Means it's undivided. There's no subject-object there. Right? So, say normally a vritti is full of nama-rupa, name and form. Whether it's an imagination or some sort of an intellection or it's a perception, that thing, whatever it is, the vritti is assuming that form is other than consciousness, in a sense. Mm-hmm. Right? In the sense that I can say everything is only consciousness, but now I'm talking about the perception of duality, mm-hmm. perceptions that take place within duality. So those are the vrittis we're used to. Mm-hmm. And you can even sit, close your eyes and watch a vritti, 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 all the vrittis passing by. If we do that in Vipassana, right? In other forms of meditation, you just sit quietly and you watch the vrittis come by, right? There's always one for associative thinking, one vritti after another. Now, even there, just doing that, you can differentiate the stable conscious being from the thought flow. Mm-hmm. Right? Okay, what if instead of the thought flow being of this and that and this and that objects, that mind is directed, focused on the consciousness that is the stable being that is pervasive to and illumining every thought. No thought is away from that stable consciousness. But the thought is usually taking on a form of something within duality. Right?
Right. So I guess I'm thinking vritti is basically a technical term for the phenomenon of name and form and or how perceptions and the mind create a certain kind of... The interaction between the senses and sense objects create a vritti, a thought. Not
right. Well, we say that there's a mind as an actual entity. It's called the antikarana.
Okay.
Okay. And then we have the mind utilizes the sense organs, and so the five sense organs feed into the mind, and the mind has vritti after vritti after vritti based upon the perceptions that are coming in.
Right.
So think of the mind as an entity. Not in the sense of duality, but it's the sattva aspect. Like you have a mind and you have sense organs. Okay. And so this mind is usually forming thought modifications based upon our perceptions, imaginations, etc. And those vrittis are illumined by consciousness. Okay. Now say knowledge is taking place. What happens? The mind then is directed not toward sensory perceptions, not even toward imaginations or names and forms of any kind, but it's directed in, it's like taking the mirror and turning it like this. Taking the vritti that is usually objectifying something within samsara and flipping it like that. So now you have the consciousness illumining a vritti that is now not objectifying any name and form at all, but rather has been directed just toward the consciousness, which is its own, really its own being.
And I'm thinking, though, if once there are no objects of consciousness, either through perception or imagination, mm-hmm. Then there's no vritti.
No, there is a vritti.
And I don't. That's the part I don't see how that is possible.
Or are you thinking? You're thinking that the vritti is one with sense perception.
Or imagination.
Or imagination.
That thought, there's
but what
object.
About when you do all kinds of work, like pranayama and japa and whatnot, to make the mind quiet?
Right.
So the only time
that I even have a cognition of myself is in contrast to some object of that comes into my awareness.
Well, what
I'm aware of the different... there's a differentiation. Otherwise, I would say... the mind then is in a state maybe of nirguna samadhi.
But nirguna? No. If you say that, We say nirvikalpa, actually. Nirvikalpa samadhi. But when you say that, what goes in the self is, we don't say the self is in samadhi. The mind
no,
is
not
in
the, not the self.
Yeah, but the mind is in samadhi.
Right.
The mind is vritti. Okay? So the vritti is in nirvikalpa samadhi. The example they use for that is like, say, for instance, if you have a sun, the sun, and you hold up a candle flame to the sun. Okay? You're holding. If you can still see the outline of the flame, that's savikalpa samadhi.
Mm-hmm.
If the overwhelming nature of the sun overwhelms that outline, that's nirvikalpa samadhi. That means that the antakarana of vritti is still there. As long as there's an antakarana, there's always a vritti. It can't be without a vritti.
Okay.
Antakarana means vritti. Even in deep sleep, there's an antisuchana vritti. It's in its causal condition. But that's why you can have memory of deep sleep and talk about it. Oh, in deep sleep, you can say all kinds of things about
it. So there's changing the subject, but there's an antisuchana vritti in deep sleep.
Well, only because the antakarana, it's in its causal condition.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But there has to be vritti there because you can remember it.
Okay, so then it's not really quite accurate to say the mind is resolved in deep sleep and there are no thoughts? Sounds like it's not quite accurate then to say.
Well, we do say it like that,
yeah.
Though.
But it sounds like it's a little inaccurate.
No, keep it like that.
Okay.
Yeah, keep it. That's a better way to say it.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to remember that when the mind wakes up,
yeah,
you can recall.
Yeah.
You know.
I didn't know that was why.
Yeah. It's memory.
Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah.
I can continue with this later, but I still have a doubt. But it does help when you say that the mind itself is, so long as there's a mind, it's understood that there is some vritti.
Yeah. Even the mind goes into causal, the mind goes into causal condition, the same mind comes back. It doesn't go into any state of non-existence. In nirvikalpa samadhi, the mind doesn't become non-existent.
No, I still don't understand how there can be a vritti of the self, of consciousness.
I'm not sure what the problem. If you can talk about nirvikalpa samadhi, then what do you think that is?
Well, my mind goes back to the Yoga Sutras. I mean, it's yoga, it's not Vedanta.
What do the Yoga Sutras say?
My mind is that samadhi is cessation of the fluctuations of the mind.
That's fine, but it doesn't say it's the absence of the mind.
No, see, then I think there's a distinction then between those vrittis, and it calls the fluctuations of the mind vrittis, that then there's a distinction between antakarana and vritti, and the vrittis can be a cessation of the vritti without the disappearance of the mind.
Oh, so you're saying cessation as though the vritti disappears from the mind.
Well, that the vritti, the way I've always visualized it,
uh-huh,
is sort of like there's this mind, and through some object of knowledge, either through perception or imagination, it causes a certain fluctuation. There's a fluctuation of that mind, which is called vritti. But it requires something with attributes to interact with it.
Okay.
And so that's why.
So, but then I see what you're saying. That's not what we're saying. So then, when you do like pranayama or you restrain the sense organs, what you're doing is restraining all of the activity in the chitta, so that it's quiet. It's completely quiet. When it's completely quiet, that itself is not enough, because then there's just what we call a jada samadhi. Okay, but now that chitta, that vritti, has become quiet, and now it's turned toward the self. We do this at this whole teaching methodology is like
that.
That
vritti turned towards the self is basically what the I thought.
Well, the I no, the I thought actually when the ahankara, the I thought, it's not the I thought. It's that the vritti, the content of the vritti, is the focus of the vritti, mm-hmm. rather than something else like a sense perception.
But what's the content of the vritti when there's the? I don't see how the when the mind is turned toward the self. What is that content?
The self.
But the self, it has no attributes. So what? How?
Well, I don't know. You mean
the vritti?
Consciousness doesn't need attributes to be consciousness.
No, but to be a vritti is
the vritti. Consciousness isn't the vritti.
No.
But the mind,
what's the vritti then in the absence of an object of cognition?
Well, it's either like a deep sleep or like a jhana samadhi where it's not, it's just total silence without any knowledge, or it's recognizing its own the own conscious being. See, like in Driktrisha Viveka, they say, you know, there's Satchit and Namarupa in everything. Satchit in any vritti. Satchit and Namarupa. If you quiet the Namarupa, you know, then for the vritti, the only thing that is there is the Satchit. So you want that vritti to recognize the Satchit differentiated from the Namarupa. So now you remove the Namarupa through, you know, we do it in the old teaching methodology by turning the mind step by step by step, differentiating it from all of the things it can objectify, and then doing an assertion, making the mind fall back on the consciousness that's illumining it.
Okay, so then that vritti then, would you say, is knownness?
That's its content. Every vritti enjoys knownness, but
right.
What if the vritti
focuses?
So
that's how the vritti can persist, even when it's turned towards consciousness, because that the basic knownness is still there.
Yes, and the basic knownness is the Atma.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
I think I'm getting it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an important way to look at it. Yeah.
Thank you.
That's good. Welcome. You have to go to bed now.